from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Ask a pet owner if animals have emotions, writes primatologist Franz DeWall, and they'll say, of course. But ask a university professor, and they'll squirm. While the leading theories in science only recognize basic emotions in animals, such as anger, happiness, and fear, DeWall argues that animals share all emotions with humans, including complex ones like hope, disappointment, guilt, and empathy. DeWall joins us in studio to discuss his decades of research on the behavior and social intelligence of primates and his new book, Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. That's coming up after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. It's common for humans to think that our rich emotional lives separate us from other species. Not so, says primatologist Franz DeWall. He argues that animals share all emotions with humans, including complex ones like hope, remorse, guilt, and empathy. And it's not just our close primate relatives. Wall writes, quote, emotions are everywhere in the animal kingdom, from fish to birds to insects, and even in brainy mollusks such as the octopus. Franz DeWall is professor of primatology at Emory University, and he's director also of the Living Links Center at the Yerkes National Primate Research Center. He joins us, and we're going to talk about many things, including his new book, which is called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. And welcome back to Forum. Good to have you with us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Well, let's begin with the title of your book. It's a story that you tell about a fellow primatologist, Jan van Hoof, who is also Dutch, as you are, and with a 59-year-old chimpanzee, and tell us the story.
Well, Jan is my professor, and he's 80 years old, and he knew Mama, the alpha female chimpanzee of that big colony there at the Arnhem Zoo. He knew her just as long, 40 years or so, and he had many positive interactions with her. Mama was a very important figure in that colony because she was sort of the one who held the whole group together and unified things and was very diplomatic. And so when she was on her deathbed, Jan decided to visit her and to say goodbye.
And it had been how long since they had been seeing each other?
Well, they saw each other probably multiple times a year. But never, he would never go in the cage with her, in the night cage. That's where she slept. And we never do that with adult chimpanzees because they are potentially very dangerous. And so in this case, he made an exception because he was on her deathbed. And she recognized him, of course, and she embraced him and had a very big smile on her face. And people were very touched by the video that was taken of it and was shown on national TV in Holland. And that they were touched, I was not so surprised by, but I was surprised by how surprised people were by the emotional display and by how similar it was to what humans do and the gestures he made and how she patted him on the neck and stuff like that. And so I decided that was a good angle to start with to explain that, yes, all the emotional expressions that we have, we can find in the chimpanzee just as well. There's not really much difference in how we express them and how they express them.
Well, you write in your book about being an observer, going back to when you're 12 years old and being very conscious of observing, mm-hmm. and you've certainly been observing primates and all animals for a long time now, and you had an experience, I believe it was in 1980, with, so you called it your favorite chimp. Mm-hmm. In the Netherlands, in the zoo in the Netherlands, somewhat similar to what you're writing about Mama.
You mean the male who got
Lewitt,
killed?
I think the name of the chimp was.
The male who got killed at the zoo. And I was really very upset by that, is that until that time I had thought, well, chimpanzees are always capable of controlling their fights. They had many power struggles and all of that had worked out one way or another. And they reconcile after their fights. But in this case, two males ganged up on another one and killed him. And I was very touched by that. And I decided I need to pay more attention to processes like empathy and reconciliation and cooperation. Because in those days, when I was a student, all that people cared about at that time was aggressive behavior. That came from Conrad Lorenz. I don't know if you know that name.
I read Conrad Lorenz.
Yeah. A wonderful writer, but he had emphasized the aggressive side of our species and the aggressive side of other species. And everyone was studying aggression after World War II, which was maybe logical after that time. And I decided to go in the opposite direction and to understand how do animals control emotions, how do they control fights, how do they reconcile. And so I got more interested in the opposite side of the competitive picture.
And I want to drill down on that, as they say, because I think that's a very important issue still. We don't know, I think, and you admit that how much we're given to aggressive and warlike behavior as opposed to what might be called our better angels in the animals of all species as well as in the human species. But first, let me talk about the fact that all animals have emotions, because that's really a hypothesis that you're working with, and you can certainly see it in primates. You even mentioned reconciliation and so forth. But where people often put up the drawbridge, they say, rats? You know, because you tell us rats have emotions. Insects, fish have emotions.
Well, that people sometimes doubted for insects, I can see, even though insects have clearly states of agitation or sleepiness, and so they have different moods, so to speak. But for all the mammals, I would say it's very obvious. The reason we talk about, for example, fear in the amygdala is out of rat studies. And then if you put humans into a brain scanner and you show them pictures that induce fear, what lights up? It's the amygdala. So the
fear of a horse is just like fear of a fish, you say at one point.
Yeah, that's probably very similar. And because the brain processes are very similar. And the bodily states, for example, for rats, we know that for humans, we say, if you're fearful, we say you're getting cold feet. Let's say you're a young man, you go to your wedding, and the young man is getting cold feet, to say. So fear induces withdrawal of blood from the extremities, and so you do literally get cold feet and cold hands if you're fearful. Now rats, if you test rats on fearful stimuli, like the odor of a predator or something like that, their feet get cold, but also the tail gets cold. And so they also withdraw blood from the extremities. And so the expression, the brain part, everything is very similar.
Well, let's talk about how we test these things, because there are all kinds of neuroscience things that you take us to and move forward, but also body language, facial expressions, chemistry, especially body chemistry and so forth. I mean, there are real ways to quantify.
Yeah, for example, stress. You can stressful situations increase the corticoids. For example, the cortisol in humans. We test that with saliva. So I can put you in a stressful situation, and in your saliva I can see a rise in cortisol levels. Now these cortisol levels also rise in all the primates. For example, Sapolsky, who lives here in San Francisco, does this research on baboons.
Been on our show a number of times. It is a friend of the show.
Yeah, and that is all very similar. That whole hormone system is extremely similar between the species.
Well, when you talk about the similarities of the species, you take on a lot of, I suppose, what could be called major thinkers, Richard Dawkins, for example, and you say, for example, and I'm using him as just one example, that he says animals aren't emotional and animals are directed by amoral genetic duplicating. This is something that you... I'm wondering, how does this bring in morality? I mean, that's one of the big questions in my mind, especially since you have people like Peter Singer who are telling us we need to, because all the species share so much with us, we need to be totally compassionate toward all of them and maybe even not eat them.
Oh, you're interested in the moral implications of this. Well, they are very obvious. As the more we know about animal emotions and cognition, the more we need to worry about them. So in the time, previous century, under Skinner, so to speak, We treated animals as stimulus response machines. They were machines, they had no emotions, they had no cognition. And basically, if they are machines, you can do whatever you want to do with them. But now we are living in a time where, like in my book, I talk about the emotions, but others talk about all the cognitive feats of certain species. Yes, we have to worry about them. And so the way we treat animals, especially in the agricultural industry, is probably not acceptable. It's something we either need to stop that or we need to change it drastically. We cannot go on simply the way we're doing.
There's so much, especially about the primates, that you see as being analogous to human emotions and human behavior, for that matter. And there's a wonderful study that I know you've written about through the years. I'd like you to talk about it, between the chimpanzees getting grapes and getting cucumbers.
Yeah, those are capuchin monkeys.
We started with
monkeys. We did the same thing on chimps, actually. But with the monkeys, we discovered that, because I had a big colony of these monkeys and we tested them every day, they lived in a group and then we took them out and put them in a test chamber. And since we always tested these monkeys in pairs, we never tested them on their own, We notice that they pay very close attention to what the other one is getting. You would think that they only worry about what do I get for the work that I perform. No, they were always watching what their neighbor was getting also. And so we started to do these tests where we have one monkey work for cucumber, the other one works for grapes, and grapes are 10 times better than cucumber. And at that point, the one who works for cucumber gets upset and doesn't want to work anymore. Even though normally, if the other one also gets cucumber, if both of them are fed cucumber, they're perfectly fine with it. And so they're very sensitive to the comparison. And we didn't speak at that time of fairness. We called it inequity aversion, is that they didn't like inequities. Because the one who gets the grapes is not really worried about the situation. But then with the chimpanzees, when we started testing chimps, who are much closer to us, we noticed that the chimp who gets the grape may also refuse the grape till the other one also gets a grape. So now we're getting very close to the human sense of fairness and striving for equal outcomes. And we tested children on the same paradigm. And we found that there was basically no difference between the chimps and the children. So if you now ask me, is the human sense of fairness different from that of a chimp? I really don't know anymore.
We're talking with Franz De Waal, primatologist from Emory University and author of Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Teach Us About Ourselves. You've also got all these studies that show chimps especially fighting and actually literally kissing and making up.
Yeah, reconciliation is very common. When I discovered that as a student, because there was some sort of accident in the group with a big fight, and I noticed that afterwards the two chimps who were in the fight reconciled. And since that time, I've been studying it. Initially, the reaction was, yeah, maybe chimps will do that on occasion, but certainly other animals will never do such things. Now we know that all social animals do. So dolphins, elephants, wolves, goats, you name it, all sorts of social animals have reconciliations after fights. And that is probably because fights are sort of inevitable if you live in a system where competition occurs. But you also live in that system because cooperation is necessary. And so you need to balance the two, and you need to compromise on occasion. You need to reconcile after fights.
This is where you become, I think, considerably more sanguine than many are about the human condition. You think, for example, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you talk about the aggression in chimps, and certainly mm-hmm. it's very notable how difficult they can be as fighters and mm-hmm. as predators, even among their own group. You say, well, emotions run concurrent with aggression, and maybe we can curb those emotions in ourselves, and the other species are able to curb as well?
Yeah, the control of emotions, that's really interesting. There's people who think that obviously animals, they are running after their emotions. They're slaves of their emotions. They have to follow their instincts and their emotions. And that is such a wrong idea, because if I were a cat and I would see a chipmunk and I would immediately follow my impulse and go after the chipmunk, I would never catch it. So the cat needs to control the impulse and start hiding and sneaking up. It may take half an hour to get to the chipmunk. And so all animals have control over their emotions, especially animals who live in hierarchies, social hierarchies, like most of the macaques, baboons. The lower ranking individuals need to control their impulses the whole day, otherwise they get into trouble. So controlling your impulses, and we have ways of testing that. In humans, we test these things with the marshmallow test. And the marshmallow test is you give a kid a marshmallow and you put them behind the table and you say, if you wait long enough, you get a second one. And then they film the struggle of these kids of sitting there with the temptation of a marshmallow. And kids can hold out for about 15 minutes on these tasks. Same thing has been done with apes. So there's a chimp sitting in a room, and there's a machine that produces every 30 seconds some candy. The candies drop in a bowl, and the chimp has learned that if he removes the bowl, then the flow of candy stops. So the chimp has to wait. And they wait also like 15 minutes, and they wait better if they can distract themselves with toys. So they have a certain willpower. And so control over the emotions, I think, is all over the place. All animals have emotions have to control them and regulate them also. And so this whole idea that we are the only ones who have free will, so to speak, free will is often defined as going against your impulses, knowing your impulses and going against them. I think many animals can do the same thing. And so if you believe in free will, I'm not a big believer, but let's say you believe in free will, You have to believe in that for your dog as well, I think.
I always loved when I was interviewing the Nobel Prize-winning writer Isaac Bashevis Singer and said, do you believe in free will? And his response was, I have no choice.
Which yeah, I know. But I know that one.
There's a kind of optimism in a lot of this about uh-huh. our capacity to maybe move away from whatever our aggressive instincts or emotions might be. Or mm-hmm. To get back to Konrad Lorenz, who thought we were almost biologically geared toward war, or being uh-huh. war makers, history bears that out, that wars throughout every civilization and throughout history.
Wait. I'm not sure that history bears that out, because the evidence for warfare in our species goes back 12,000 years, but not further. We don't have evidence from before the agricultural revolution. So I'm not convinced that we have always been waging war. We have been waging war for the last 12,000 years, which is a long time, of course, but for the biologists, that's a very short period of time.
I know this is your point of view, and when I say I want to drill down on this, I really do, because you also have said, use the example of Columbus, and the natives turn up and they bring gifts to Columbus, and Columbus mm-hmm. thinks about, I have a sword, I have 50 people, I could just massacre all of them. Yeah. And there's your civilization, is what Franz De Waal says, right?
Yeah, that was my take on Steve Pinker saying that civilization has rescued us from these basic instincts, which is a very Freudian idea, I think, because Freud...
We're moving up with evolution.
Moving forward.
Yeah,
civilization is rescuing us. And if you look at the history of our civilization meeting... people who, so to speak, have no civilization, because that's how we look at that. We have been the aggressors, not them.
But it seems like you are emphasizing, and kudos for this, I'd like to believe it's actually the fact, the peaceful nature, the potential for peace in all of our species, including, I mean, because animals reflecting humans, and you say they live peacefully. We can live peacefully.
Yeah, and you know, I grew up as a student in the time of the 70s and 80s where everything turned about aggression and competition and selfishness, and we were a totally selfish species, and all the other animals were selfish too. And now we are at the point, fortunately, where people know that actually our first inclination is trust and cooperation. If you meet a stranger... Unless this stranger has been nasty to you. But if he's a friendly stranger, your first inclination is to try to cooperate. And I think the same is true for many primates. They are very social creatures. And if they meet someone, that's how they look at it.
Fairness and compassion, back to morality, you say are the pillars of morality. And animals, in fact, lean toward those, fairness and compassion.
Yeah, so I think the two pillars of human morality, I think, are reciprocity, and reciprocity relates to fairness and justice and things like that, and compassion and empathy. And empathy, we do an enormous amount of studies. We do now actually empathy studies on rodents, on mice and rats. And so, but it started with my studies of the chimpanzees where we looked at consolation. So we looked at how do chimpanzees respond to someone who's distressed. That's also how the empathy studies on humans actually started. The human study started with asking a family member to cry and then see how young children responded to them. And that kind of consolation behavior, that is all over the place in the mammals. So all the mammals show some of that.
There's a line between mammals and others, isn't there? Huh?
Yeah, so birds, I think there's some evidence for them too. But I don't know about other species, like, let's say, reptiles or fish or so. I'm involved, actually, in a fish study on empathy, so I wouldn't exclude these things, but I think the evidence is not really strong.
And what about different breeds? I mean, could angelfish be more empathic, possibly, than catfish or something along those lines? I mean, certainly you see different dog breeds that are more aggressive, and other dog breeds are much more docile.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you mention angelfish. I think the discus fish, which is a bit related, they have care for their young. Some of these fish, they care for their young. And as soon as you get that kind of systems where they are attached and care for their young, you may also get empathic responses, I think. And that's a possibility. I'm not sure about catfish. I don't want to go into the catfish.
Well, you write about dolphin and killer whale mothers carrying the bodies of their dead children. And, of course, we mm-hmm. know about elephants with burials. And, I mean, all these things are very human.
Yeah. So the grieving process, as soon as you have attachments, which you have in all the mammals, you can also get grieving because then they may lose a partner, especially if a female loses her offspring. That was the case with the orcas. It was an orca female in the Pacific who lost a calf and carried it around for 17 days. And so that was a whole grieving process right there.
And if you'd like to join this conversation, let me invite you to do that now. Franz de Waal is our guest, and he's a primatologist and certainly well known for so much of his work through the years. I think we last had you on with your bonobo book, and his new book is called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Teach Us About Ourselves. We do invite your participation, and you can join us now at our toll-free number, the number to call, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program with any questions or comments. Number again, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post questions or comments there at kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, and you can also, of course, go to our Facebook page. But we do want to hear from you and have you be part of this conversation. Let's go back to chimps. A lot of sharing goes on with chimps.
Food sharing, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's something that they do very easily. We tested, for example, by giving a group of, let's say, 20 chimps, we give them some large watermelons. And a watermelon is basically too big for one chimp, and it's easily shared because they can also monopolize it, but they can also share it. The funny thing is, if you introduce them to watermelons like that, they don't fight at all. You would expect with 20 chimps and you have, let's say, three watermelons that there's an enormous brawl that you get. No, they just go to the watermelons. They have a lot of happy pant grunts. They pick up the melons and they walk away. There's no fight at all. And I think it is because everyone knows they will get part of it. Because the chimp who has the watermelon usually is sharing, sometimes very easily, sometimes a bit reluctantly, but they share quite easily.
So what does this say about those who argue for socialism or against socialism or for capitalism and against capitalism? Yeah. Especially, you know, you've got this idea of Darwinian capitalism, et cetera, that has been turned into a kind of dog-eat-dog.
Yeah, the funny thing is when we did our study on the fairness experiments on the capuchin monkeys, we got angry letters of people who said, you must be communists because you say that fairness is natural. Even though I look at my capuchin monkeys as little capitalists because they are comparing income, basically. But yeah, that was their interpretation. You get always these ideological interpretations. For example, if you talk about sex differences in the primates, there's always people who are going to get upset because the males are dominant or the females are such and such. And they all have these opinions of how they should behave.
Well, what do you think about animal behavior? What do you want to know about animal emotions? It's not just anger, fear, and happiness, Franz de Waal says. It's all emotions that animals share with us, hope, empathy, disappointment, guilt, and you talk about the whole range. He talks about the whole range, and there are so many examples of how they mirror us and how they indeed, I mentioned bonobos, for example. Bonobos have deep belly laughs. and listeners want to know about dog emotions. Dogs actually hang their heads in shame, as some of you know, and all of this can be pretty much cataloged. Also talking about horses rolling their eyes out of fear. So things that you can observe. I go back to Franz de Waal as a 12-year-old writing about his observing people on the buses in the Netherlands, his home country. So let's hear from you, and when we return, we will hear from you. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. You're listening to the Forum program on KQED Public Radio. We're talking this hour with about animal emotions with primatologist Franz de Waal. He's the author of Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. And we're going to go to our listeners here in just a moment. I want to clarify one thing, though, from the last half hour that we were speaking about in conversation when I was talking about Conrad Lorenz. I think you've said yourself that it's still the answers are out or maybe moot as to how much we are biologically driven as humans or, for that matter, other species toward being war makers.
Yeah, so when people make the argument that we have a natural inclination for warfare, they often bring up the chimpanzee. Chimpanzees
or baboons, yeah.
Yeah, baboons less so, I think, because baboons don't kill between troops necessarily, but chimpanzees do. Yeah. Chimpanzee males will invade the territory of their neighbors and try to get the males and try to kill them. And I always see the limitations of that comparison because I also work on bonobos, which are equally close to us, genetically exactly equally close. The anthropologists always forget about the bonobos because they're female-dominated, they're very sexy, they're very peaceful, they don't wage war at all because the groups, when they meet in the forest, they mingle, they have sex, and they groom, and it looks more like a picnic than like warfare. And the anthropologists, some anthropologists at least, they can't stand the bonobo because their whole worldview of the human species is based on the idea that we have eliminated the Neanderthals. We have eliminated one after the other, and we are the survivors and the victors of the evolutionary race. And the bonobo being so peaceful doesn't really suit them so well. But I think we should look at the bonobo. Evolution takes place equally along the female line than the male line, so all this emphasis on male stuff and warfare and so on, I think, is exaggerated. And we should look at the bonobo as well.
You wrote an article about Donald Trump as being sort of an alpha male, or at least an aspiring alpha male.
Yeah, the term alpha male comes, the popularity comes largely from my book Chimpanzee Politics, and so I feel a bit responsible for all the use of alpha male in Washington. And I have problems with applying the word alpha male for a bully. So someone who's an alpha male is the top male, usually. That's what we call the alpha male. So in that sense, every politician who's at the top is the alpha male automatically. But they are not always bullies. And so there's many alpha males that I have known who keep the group together and keep the peace and are the consoler in chief. And so many alpha males who are good leaders are very popular as a result. So in that sense, I think there's some limitations on application of that label.
Maybe it's the diversity of the human species that we're talking about here and the range of it, the whole spectrum of it.
In the human species.
Yeah, well, no, for that matter, you're talking about chimpanzees who can be very aggressive and chimpanzees who are pacific
and so forth.
Let me get some callers aboard, and let's start with the caller named Becky. Becky, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Long-time listener. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I've been observing squirrel behavior for any number of years in my yard, and I've gotten to know individual squirrels, and a mother squirrel who had an adult, sort of almost adult young squirrel who seemed to have sort of a disability. She was sort of looking after it. And my pets, my dog and cat, killed the squirrel, the baby. And that mother got so upset that she scolded me and the pets and then went and dragged the body of the little squirrel, who was almost an adult, to the base of her tree. And I had never seen anything like it, having always assumed they just didn't have any kind of strong attachment to each other. I've also observed spider behavior where the mother opening up the nest for the babies to come out. And so I think there's a lot we don't know about the emotions of just even these ordinary animals.
Well, maternal protection, of course, is in many animals, especially in mammals, is extremely developed and is one of the fiercest forms of aggression that you can ever see is a female who defends her offspring. We know that for bears and tigers, and we also know that for many species. And so,
including humans.
Yeah, it's a very strong, extremely strong emotion. Yeah.
Becky, thank you for that call. Arachnids, though, do we associate them with emotion, too?
Who?
We're talking about insects, spiders.
Spiders, well, I think insects have emotional states, but we know very little about it because the word emotion, of course, for most of the last century was taboo and was certainly not used for insects. But I think that's going to come one day.
Well, here's a listener, Derek, who says, I've heard Professor DeWalt distinguish between emotions and feelings, but I use these words as synonyms. How does he define emotions versus feelings?
Yeah, that's a good one. So the feelings are private states. I cannot know the feelings of a chimpanzee or an elephant. I really cannot know because they're private states. It's basically you become conscious of your emotions, and that's a feeling. And we humans, we can talk about our feelings, and so we communicate our feelings by language and our emotions in the face. Usually we trust actually the facial expressions, we trust the expression of the emotions better than the feelings that are reported. So if you say, for example, that you're so happily married and you divorce a month later, I think I'm going to wonder whether I could have told from your facial expressions how happy you were, really. So I have trouble with...
In the world of poker, we call this a tell. People's facial expressions are telling of what they really feel. Yeah.
So in humans, we have the feelings that are being reported verbally. I'm not sure that I know your feelings. So you can tell me that you're sad, for example, at a funeral. But is your sadness the same as my sadness? It's very hard for me to know. So feelings are hard to know in humans and impossible to know in animals. But emotions are expressed in the body. They live sort of between the mind and the body. And in the face, in the voice, in your blood pressure, in your heart rate, your body is always responding to emotions. And so emotions can be measured objectively. We cannot measure them in a chimp. We can measure them in a human. Emotions are completely open to science. And so this whole story that we should stay away from the emotions because it's an inner state is actually wrong. It's a state that is visible on the outside.
Emotions change, though. I mean, and humans edit their emotions in many respects. They have to do with the present time they're in as opposed to the past time. So they're in flux.
How do you edit your emotions?
You can regulate them. Well, often I cite a writer named Kozinski, Jerzy Kozinski, who's not read much anymore, but he used to say we use our emotions to accommodate to our memories and our memories to accommodate to our emotions. And there's, I think, a lot to that. Oh. But we don't know with animals, really, do we?
No, we know about emotion regulation in animals. So animals can regulate their emotions. But whether they can edit them, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know exactly what that is, actually.
We'll get some more callers on and we'll think about it. We'll try to regulate it. Melissa, you're our next caller. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, long-time listener, and this is fascinating. Just speaking of tells, when I put a certain food under one of my cat's noses, she'll look down if she wants it, and that tells me I should go ahead and feed it to her. So I love knowing that. It saves a lot of food. My question may be an odd one, at least it is to me, but here's what I'm wondering. I know we talk a lot about what we can learn from observing animals about ourselves, and I just wonder if we can flip that question around a little and say, what do animals learn from us? And I'm thinking maybe not just those in captivity who learn language and things like that, but is there any other sort of behavior that animals tend to pick up around us and adopt, maybe long-term, maybe evolutionarily?
Yeah, I think for animals that we keep in the home or that we have at zoos and so on, you would expect that they can learn things from humans, that they see humans do things that they may want to imitate. But animals in the wild, I'm not sure that there's... There are, of course, reports that there were speculations, for example, because chimpanzees crack nuts in the forest with stones, and then there were speculations that maybe they had seen humans do that. But now we have evidence from certain field sites that some of these chimp populations have been doing this for thousands of years in the forest and probably in remote forests where humans never appeared. So we now think that actually the chimps invented it really themselves. But yeah, that's an interesting question, certainly for animals who live with us.
Let me thank the caller. And Alex tweets, tell us about dog emotions.
Dog emotions, well, the question of guilt, for example, always comes up. So do dogs have guilt? And people have done experiments on this, and where you present them with situations where they have done nothing wrong, but you're scolding them, for example. And do they still show guilt responses because they have this guilty look that they can produce? And the consensus until now for many people has been that dog guilt is actually anticipation of punishment. I'm personally not convinced that human guilt is totally different, but let's stick with the dog. Dog guilt is anticipation of punishment. But I've also heard many stories, and that's why we probably need more experiments on this whole thing, is of people who come home and the dog has done something wrong, but they don't know anything about this. These people come home and see their dogs, and one of the dogs has this very guilty look on his face, and then later they discover that he has done something like destroying a pillow or something like that. And if that is the case, then it's not just anticipation of punishment in the sense that you've been scolding them. It is really something that is an inner state. And so we need more experiments on the dog guilt, but that is an issue that always comes up.
Question from Pete. Aside from the primates, what animals display the most emotion that we think we understand?
Yeah, the primates have a lot of muscles in the face and so have a lot of facial expressions. There was a time where people said, well, clearly, humans have more shades of emotions, and so humans must have the most muscles in the face because we need to communicate them. Then 5 years ago or so, a team analyzed post-mortem in chimpanzees how many muscles they have in the face, and they have exactly the same number of muscles as us. And so the chimp is potentially capable of expressing the same range of emotions that we do. Another group of animals that has so many muscles in the face is the horse. The horse family, zebras, horses, donkeys, and so on, the horse family has an enormous amount of muscles in the face. And on top of that, they can move their ears back and forth, which we unfortunately cannot do. We have these fixed ears in place. So the horse has an enormous range of expressions, and people are now starting to discover that.
You mentioned horses. I remember looking at a scale. I don't know if it still holds up, about animal intelligence. And at the top were the primates, baboons, chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas. And as you went down, it went down to actually elephants. Raccoons are much smarter than most people think. Horses were down, this is like in the top 12 or something, down near the bottom. So the sort of experience you have watching movies where a horse is called for and, you know, pulls out the jail bar and those sorts of things that we saw, particularly when we were young.
I don't like those scales at all. There's,
I don't either, but
they're highly misleading.
Because there's too much mix where intelligence is concerned. I understand that. But if you can determine higher intelligence, more gray matter, I don't know what else, is there a correlation between that and emotions?
You mean the more
the complexity of the emotion, the more intelligent, the more complex?
That's very well possible. That's very well possible. But apart from the primates, we now look at the cetaceans like dolphins and orcas as highly intelligent. We look at certain corvids like crows and ravens as highly intelligent. We look at the magpie as very. So it's more like a tree. You have a tree with many branches in many different directions and specializations. And yes, some species may have more emotions than others. I think we're at the point where we're allowed to talk about emotions, but we have barely scratched the surface on that. Yeah.
We'll go to more of your calls. Janet, thank you for waiting. You're on the Year End Forum. Good morning.
Oh, you're welcome. Good morning. So I have been taking care of two elderly horses for about 10 years, two male horses. They're very attached, and recently we had to make the very difficult decision to let one of them go, and it was all planned and done very well, but the remaining horse, Thunder, is suffering a great deal, and the loss is so profound. I just can't even tell you the emotions. The first night, I spent the night at the barn with him because he was crying all night long. And he, because I see him every day, and I've been with him every day. He's not having eye contact with me. He doesn't want to be touched. This is not his normal behavior, and so the grief that he's feeling is palpable. And I can't even tell you how incredible this is to watch this whole thing unfolding.
Yeah, these attachments, as soon as you have attachments, you can get grieving. And attachments can be very strong, especially between male and female in birds, for example. I've had this situation with birds where I had two birds who were like corvids who were a pair, and the female disappeared at some point, and the male called for 2 weeks and then died. And so these things happen. We also know this kind of stories of dogs who lose their master. There's a famous dog in a little statue in front of one of the Tokyo railway stations, because
that was a movie with Richard Gere, in fact.
He came for 7 years or whatever. He came every day to the train to pick up his master who had passed away. And so the faithfulness of dogs and So yes, the animals can be extremely affected by the loss. Of course, especially females who lose their offspring. That's also a very typical situation. And so, yes, grieving, I think, can be very intense.
Let me thank the caller. There's also, I'll try to give a quick anecdote of this. My daughter had a cat named Katrina, and it was in terrible shape and was being tended to in the upstairs of the house, and came downstairs after being upstairs and being clearly unable to walk or ambulatory for quite some time, came downstairs to say goodbye, really. It was clear that the cat knew that it was dying, and it did die right after that.
Yeah, I always wonder if animals know about their own mortality. So they have very strong responses to the death of others. For example, chimpanzees may stop eating for a couple of days and make no sound at all if one of them has died. So they're very strongly affected by the death of somebody else, especially if they have seen that individual in a dead state. For example, with Mama, the chimpanzee that we talked about in the beginning, we released the whole colony to to say goodbye to her when she had died. And yes, they were extremely affected. But whether they know themselves that this may happen one day to them, the sense of mortality, that's a big question.
It's a big question for humans too, isn't it? You can't imagine your own...
I think we know, but we try to suppress the information.
It's still hard to conceptualize. Let me get a Joe on. Joe, you're on. Morning.
Hi, thanks. Great subject. Love your books. You guys have made such tremendous strides in realizing things that everybody thought was unthinkable and ridiculous and all that sort of stuff. As you look to the future, are there things that you think, are there things that you suspect may be true but haven't been proven by research? For example, language dolphins, are we going to understand them, you think, anytime soon? I mean, what things do you think might happen in the future that people today might think are outlandish but you suspect may be proven true?
Yeah, so one of the things we just talked about, the difference between feelings and emotions are expressed and measurable, and feelings are unfortunately not measurable, certainly not in animals. I think it is potentially possible that neuroscience is going to solve that riddle, is that they're going to tell us whether animals experience certain states that are similar to our states. And so then we would know more about not just the emotions, we would also know something about the feelings. I think that is really possible. You know, like when Skinner's thinking was dominant in the previous century, people didn't even want to think about neuroscience. He talked about a black box and everyone stayed in there. We would never know it. But the neuroscientists are breaking open that black box. And so that is happening at this very moment. And I wouldn't rule out that we know more about consciousness and feelings in the future.
You mentioned dolphins. We know, for example, dolphins have more convolutions on their brain than humans. Mm-hmm. And there's a correlation between that and intelligence. There's a lot to learn about dolphins still, extraordinary amount, isn't there?
Yeah. And dolphins, it's an interesting thing about dolphins, they don't have facial expressions. And so they have always their permanent smile, so to speak. And there are, of course, theories about the basic emotions in humans, the six basic emotions, which are entirely based on the face. What do we do with species that don't have facial expressions? I think no one will say that dolphins don't have emotions. That would be a ridiculous statement. But
they even have sexual perversions.
Well, they're a bit like bonobos in that regard, is that they have a lot of non-reproductive sexual contact. I wouldn't call it a perversion. I think that's a moral statement right there.
Well, I think they come under that category in the Homo sapiens species. But let me get to a listener's comment here. I wonder, this listener writes, if these emotions may evolutionarily predate Homo sapiens, could it be that emotions exist in a deeper and more primitive portion of the brain?
Yeah, that's, of course, Jaak Panksepp, who did the neuroscience on the emotions. That's what he would argue, is that they're subcortical, that maybe the feeling states that where we become conscious of the emotions, maybe those are in the prefrontal cortex, but the emotions themselves are very primitive and very old. I compare them with organs. I don't have in my body any organ that you don't find in a rat or any other vertebrate, basically. I have lung, liver, kidneys, and so on. And I think for the emotions, the same thing. They evolved over a very long period of time. They are clearly adaptive. Many of them, like disgust and fear and anger, they are adaptive emotions. And they evolved similarly in us as in other species. And so, yes, they're very ancient.
Our guest is Franz De Waal. His new book is Mama's Last Hug, and our next caller is Wynn. Wynn, welcome.
Thanks. With all the DNA and brain testing going on with humans and chimps, do we know what percentage of DNA we share with chimps, and do we also know what regions of the brain may also be the same between chimps and humans?
We have the answers to both those, don't we?
Yeah, I think we do. For DNA, I think it is 98.6% that is identical between humans and chimps and bonobos. Bonobos should be counted in there as well. As far as the brain is concerned, that's really interesting. There's not a single part in the human brain that you don't find in a monkey brain. So the human brain is really not special. The size is bigger. We have a big brain. So we have a more powerful computer, but we don't have a different computer.
But male brains are bigger than female brains, and I don't know that it's necessarily a better process of thought in men
than women. If you correct the size of the brain for the body size, then the male brain is just the same as the female.
Disproportionately.
Yeah, it's just proportionally.
Here's a listener who says, I'm curious to hear about how dogs and cats handle the divorce of their people parents. My former partner and I have recently separated, and I'm worried that it will take its toll on our dog, Buster. He's 10 and has lived with both of us for 6 years.
I don't know about that. I bet it has an effect if one of the partners disappears from view, yeah.
Elizabeth writes, I'm wondering about the moose. Have you studied their emotions and how they display them?
I don't know anything about moose. Is this a Canadian who's calling in? Or
I don't know. Maybe a Canadian. Here's Ben who says, are there interesting findings regarding group size and levels of empathy? For instance, is one ant in a colony more empathic than a sole panther?
Oh, yeah. Animals who are solitary hunters. So, for example, the domestic cat is actually a solitary hunter. And we know that, for example, reconciliation behavior is not really very highly developed. And that's maybe because they don't need partners and they can do things on their own. And so you don't need to have compromises in a social system. So, yes, animals who are solitary, they may have a different set of emotions. But I still think that on occasion, when they meet a partner, for example, for mating, or when they have offspring, they need these social tendencies in the same way that other species do.
Another interesting question from a listener named Larry, who asks, we've heard a lot about the numerous similarities between humans and other animals. Can the guest address anything he has demonstrated or believes to be truly unique to humans?
Yeah, the only thing I think is unique is the human language. All animals have communication, of course, going on, and sometimes very complex communication, and we don't know enough about certain kinds. But I think symbolic, learned communication, the way we have it, that is so versatile, human language is so extremely versatile, I think that is a unique feature. But in terms of socio-emotional tendencies, I really don't see big difference between us and, let's say, the great apes, which are our closest relatives.
What about the facile remarks that you often hear, that animals are not as filled with enmity or animosity as human beings, or they're not as jealous, or they're not as envious, those kinds of things? They just don't hold up?
Envy, you know, our monkey experiment with the grape and the cucumber is, of course, an envy response that we measure there, and is quite strong. So jealousy and envy, I think, are very well developed in some species. Jealousy you can easily see in your dog. But, of course, in the old days, people would say you should not use these terms, you should, because that's anthropomorphic to talk about jealousy in a dog. But I think we should be free to discuss these concepts. I am not convinced that our emotions go deeper or are stronger than in other species.
Yeah, you kind of hit hard on the notion of anthropomorphism that has taken too far. You talk about anthropodenial as being really the key to this. Let's flesh that out a little bit.
Yeah, so anthropodenial is the counter term that I invented, because each time we present something about animals that they are smart or that they have emotions, we get hit over the head with the term anthropomorphic. We should not be anthropomorphic. And so you should not speak of, let's say, reconciliation in chimpanzees. You should call it post-conflict contact or something like that. And I'm very opposed to that. I feel if you have similar processes under similar circumstances in related species, you have to use the same terminology and the same explanation for what they do. And so I'm perfectly happy to talk about reconciliation in chimps or jealousy in dogs. And so I invented the term anthropodenial to indicate the people who want to drive a wedge between us and other species and who are in denial about the connections and consider humans as totally unique, certainly in mind, maybe not in body, but certainly in mind. And I think a lot of the academic world is still in anthropodenial. If you go to departments of anthropology and philosophy, some parts of psychology, the humanities, you see a lot of denial of the connection between us and other species. And I consider that detrimental. It's detrimental to the understanding of ourselves. So it's actually more dangerous, I think, than anthropomorphism. And it is detrimental to what we do to Earth, because I think the ecological catastrophe that we have at the moment, the global warming that's going on, is partly a result of our inclination to see ourselves as separate from nature. We can do whatever we want with nature. Who cares? We are not part of nature. And I think that's a very dangerous attitude that is related to how we look at animals also.
There's a listener named Trish who writes, I once witnessed a wild display of alarm by crows when one of them was electrocuted on a power pole across the street. Their cacophony drew our attention as the flock flailed about as their buddy died and fell to the ground. There was a vigil of sorts until traffic made that too dangerous, but several crows hung about for quite a long time. Another listener says, I found the book about bonobos fascinating, but what is the relevance to humans?
Well, the relevance is that these are our closest relatives. At least we should know about them. That's the minimum statement that I can make. But also, I think it sheds light of on our species if we know more about our close relatives, in the sense that we have a tendency of thinking that what we do is absolutely, totally unique. And, of course, in my work, I try to undermine that view by saying, well, we are not so unique, and we are part of nature, and we are part of the primate order. So I think it gives a different perspective on the human species that is important. There's not an immediate practical application. There's no money in the statement, and there's no business in it, but I think it enlightens us about ourselves.
Well, you have done a lot to enlighten us, and I appreciate very much the work you've done and having you with us this hour. Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
For
You're
being
welcome.
Here. Franz De Waal, his new book is called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Teach Us About Ourselves. He's a primatologist at Emory University and certainly well-known throughout the world for his work in primatology. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. You can continue this discussion online, kqed.org/forum. And we invite you to do that. And Forum Program is produced by Judy Campbell, Tina Lauberg, Susan Britton, and Ariana Prale. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer today is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Caroline Smith and Sam Klein-Markman. Executive editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. Thank you for being a part of this morning's program. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.